I'm not going to give any assignment for this coming Monday. It is very difficult in a course like this to make a reasonable mark on the basis of simply an examination. So I would like to give two short tests during the semester, which will be a real help for that purpose. So for next week, there will be no assignment, but please thoroughly review everything covered thus far. And that will include all the undergraduate assignments and everything done in class. And we will have a 20-minute test at the beginning of the hour next week. I don't want to lose much time by it, so please be here promptly next week. And we will take the first 20 minutes and then immediately collect all the papers, because we have much material to cover this semester. We have been laying groundwork largely so far. There are a great many things that all fit together, and we're looking at different aspects of them as we try to fit them together. Now I want to say a few words about the assignment for today. There is much variety in the answers, as would be expected. Most of these assignments are not a test of how well you can do a thing, but they are to get you into the problem, to have you try to see what you can do on it and get the problems in mind, and then we can discuss them intelligently together. Now, there are, of course, in this, there's one thing we can all agree on, is that chapter 7 to 12 is one unit. We don't have time in this class to look at what precedes and what follows to see evidence for that, but it is definitely one unit, and perhaps on the scale we were using, perhaps you would need four lines before and after chapter 7 to 12. Then within that area, there are many short sections, some of which belong rather closely together. So there are many places where we could make a small division, but to know where the larger division should be made is not easy. I think the Archbishop did one of the worst jobs he did anywhere in the Bible in this section from 7 to 12, because there's only one of his chapter divisions which seems to me to be reasonably placed. Briefly, we'll glance at that now. You notice that in chapter 7, we are reading about the attack being made by the people from Samaria and from Damascus, and how God would protect them from them, but Ahaz has gotten the king of Assyria to come and deliver them from them. And Isaiah said in chapter 7, he said that in verse 16, before the boy knows enough to reject the wrong and choose the right, the land of the two kings you dread will be laid waste. And then in the next chapter, chapter 8, we read in verse 4, before the boy knows how to say my father or my mother, the wealth of Damascus and the plunder of Samaria will be carried off by the king of Assyria. So we have chapter 8 and chapter 7, the first part of chapter 8 and chapter 7 very tightly bound together. And there is certainly a minor division between chapter 7 and chapter 8, but I'm not at all sure it's any more important than other divisions within chapter 7. I hope we will get time to go into chapter 8 quite a bit in detail before the end of the hour. But I want now to look further on to the beginning of chapter 9. You have, I think, at the end of verse 18, the beginning of verse 19 in chapter 8, you have a break that is far more important than the break between chapters 8 and 9. Temporarily, we have left Damascus, Samaria, and Assyria behind. And we're moving into a different area in verse 19. When men tell you to consult mediums and spiritists who whisper and mutter, should not a people inquire of their God? Why consult the dead on behalf of the living? And then you have an account of punishment God is bringing to his erring people. Distressed and hungry, they roam through the land. They They look toward the earth and see only distress and darkness. There's gloom, there's distress. In the past, he humbled the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali. But the people walking in darkness are going to see a great light. So from at verse 19, there is a very important break. But at the beginning of chapter 9, there is a very slight break. If you look up any of the verses in chapter 9 in the Hebrew Bible, you will find the numbers are different from those in your English versions. Because the people who transferred the verse divisions from the Latin Bible to the Hebrew Bible felt that where it says in verse 2 here, the people walking in darkness have seen a great light, that was the place to start chapter 9. Not after the verse before, which speaks about gloom and distress and humbling. And so the Hebrew Bible, chapter 9, starts a verse later. Actually, it shouldn't start at either of the two places. It should start a few verses earlier, because we're right in the middle of a transition here. There's a much more important break earlier, and a far more important break at the end of verse 7 of chapter 9. I think most everybody saw that there is no substantial break at the beginning of verse 10. There the archbishop certainly was asleep when he made that break there, because, as I believe most of you noticed, there is a series of four stanzas making one poem, a poem of four stanzas, each of which ends with a refrain. One begins in chapter 9, verse 8, and in verse 12 says, "Yet for all this, his anger is not turned away, his hand is still upraised." Then you have another stanza, which in verse 17 ends, "Yet for all this, his anger is not turned away, his hand is still upraised." Then another, which ends at verse 21, "Yet for all this, his anger is not turned away, his hand is still upraised." And then another, which ends in chapter 10, verse 4, "Yet for all this, his anger is not turned away, his hand is still upraised." And so it's very obvious that you have there a section of four stanzas together, and he made a chapter division just at the beginning of the third. So you have a connected section there, and then a new subject begins in verse 5 of chapter 10. "Woe to the Assyrian, the rod of mine anger." And that continues on, and when you come to the end of the chapter, you have the Lord destroying the Assyrian Empire. "He will cut down the forest thickets with an axe. Lebanon will fall before the Mighty One." The great forest of Lebanon standing as a figure for the mighty Assyrian Empire that is going to perish. But the next verse says, in contrast with this great Assyrian Empire that perishes forever, that a shoot will come up from the stump of Jesse. From his roots a branch will bear fruit. And so you have the sharp contrast between the last verse of chapter 10 and the first verse of chapter 11. And there certainly is a minor break there, because you have the contrast between the destruction and failure of Assyria and the fact that from little Israel, from out of that, is going to come the one who is going to change the condition of the whole world. And so while the first verses of chapter 9 and chapter 11 are so very important that it's rather nice for us to have them be the beginning of a chapter, yet if we don't realize that it's not a major division, we lose the progress of thought and their close relationship to what precedes. Now, of course, at the beginning of verse 12, we have a prayer of praise, which goes through the chapter. So I think the archbishop did a good job at that particular point. So much for this summary of the division. The thing I want to get across is that in studying any part of the Bible, the verse divisions and chapter divisions can be a very great convenience to find a place quickly. And they're extremely valuable for that. But if you're reading any chapter, almost Old or New Testament, I think you're very wise to look a little bit at the chapter before and a little bit at the chapter after. In Hebrews, for instance, practically every chapter begins, "Therefore." And you could consider the first verse of almost every chapter of Hebrews as either a conclusion to what precedes or as a beginning of what follows. But if you divide them into separate units, you lose a great deal of the meaning of each. Do you have a question, Mr. Mullen? Chapter 8, verse 18, you say? Yes. Well, verse 18 says, "We are signs and symbols in Israel from the Lord Almighty who dwells on Mount Zion. When men tell you to consult mediums and spiritists who whisper and mutter, should not a people inquire of their God?" Well, personally, it seems to me, particularly in view of the context before and after, that there's a rather important break there. But if verse 19 was thought of as don't consult mediums and spiritists, come to us, from that viewpoint, it could be thought of as continuous. I hope we'll get to that today and look at it a little more in detail. Now, just one second. Oh, I should not forget to mention this, that I like at the end of the semester, with the two brief tests and the final exam, in practically every case, it's not difficult to tell what sort of mark I should give. But sometimes the person is right on the line between the two. And therefore, I like to keep all the papers you turn in, so that in such a case, I can look at them then in order to see which side of the line you would go. And that's why I do have record of them each week, general record of whether the work is well done or not. But I like to be able to glance over them all at the end. So unless anyone has a special reason to want a paper back sooner, I would rather not give any of the papers back till the end of the semester. Now, if any of you would like to have the paper back at the end of the semester, and there are one or two who have mentioned it, I wish you would give me just a little note. It's all right if you put it at the end of one of your assignments, but it'd be a little more convenient to me if you would give me a little separate piece of paper with a request that your papers be returned to you, and then I'll keep those all together. And at the end of the semester, I'll put them in your box, any who would like to have them. Now, we have been noticing in chapter 7 these two major emphases. The emphasis on security, the security of the people, and the emphasis on the promise to David, the promise of a righteous king, a promise which seemed to have failed when there was such a king as Ahaz, but a promise which he is assured will be carried out. Well, now, the one on security, perhaps whether to make it a separate subject or a part of that, we mentioned that there are two aspects to that. There is God's determination to punish and chastise those who err, those who do not follow him as they should, but also the promise that God's mercy will not depart, that God is going to give deliverance. He's going to give ultimate, complete establishment of righteousness. And those who follow him truly are going to find that everything turns out well in the end. And we have both of these themes, you might say, brought out in the section you looked at in chapters 36 and 37. Where we have the land subjected to the terrible attack from the Assyrians, with all the large cities except Jerusalem captured. Jerusalem was never besieged at this time, but Jerusalem was knew that the other cities were taken, that the Assyrian armies were moving back and forth through the land. No one dared go very far outside the walls for a period of perhaps 3 years. They could go out to their fields long enough to quickly pick whatever they could that had grown of itself while keeping a lookout lest Assyrian soldiers be seen approaching. And it was after constantly expecting that the great force which had broken down the walls of all their other cities would come and would attack Jerusalem. And then God miraculously delivered them. And so we have this marvelous deliverance to which we are looking forward in this section, though it's not so specifically mentioned in 7 to 12 as it is in the later section that we will look at. Now we have then constantly rebuke for iniquity, promise though that God is going to protect his people, God is going to work out his righteousness in the end, he's going to give this marvelous deliverance to Jerusalem, so that Jerusalem lasted for more than a century longer than Samaria did before it finally was taken, and then not by the Assyrians, but by the Babylonians. Now we have looked at everything in chapter 7, really, except three verses we have touched upon. Now, I appreciate it if any of you, if there's anything I don't make clear, or if I misspeak myself, which is very easy to do, and say a word that is not what I mean at all, I wish you would interrupt in such a case so that no one will be misled. Yes? They are found throughout the section. The two main emphases, which we found particularly in 7, were the security of the people, the question of the security, and the promise about the righteous king. Those are the two. And then the first of them, you might say, has two aspects, the punishment to his people when they go astray, but the ultimate victory that he promises. Now, they're found throughout, but they're emphasized in chapter 7. But in chapter 7, these three verses, verse 14 to 15, we have not looked at closely. I was a little disappointed that there was only one paper turned in to me that raised the question about these three verses, because these three verses present a very serious problem, an extremely serious problem, and I'm pleased when you note any really serious problem enough to raise a question about it on a paper. I'd rather any such things were raised on a paper given to me than in class, because I can see where I want to fit it in later, where I want to fit it best, whether it's something we're going to cover anyway, whether it's something of general interest, or whether it's something I should speak with you about personally. But the great problem in these three verses, of course, is that the first verse clearly is a prediction of the virgin birth of Christ, and yet verses 15 and 16 so very definitely refer to the immediate situation. And of course, those who insist that there is no prophecy of Christ here say, what comfort would it be for Ahaz to see this, to have this sign come of the virgin birth? Well, of course, God is not choosing to comfort Ahaz. He's rebuking Ahaz. But he is comforting the people by giving them the assurance that the house of David will not always be represented by such an unworthy representative as Ahaz, but that God's own chosen Emmanuel, the son of David, is coming, and coming in a miraculous way. But in the immediate situation, verse 15 seems to have a very definite relationship. It says, he will eat curds and honey when he knows enough to reject the wrong and choose the right. But before the boy knows enough to reject the wrong and choose the right, the land of the two kings you dread will be laid waste. Well, if it says before Christ reaches the age where he is has intelligence enough to reach for the warm milk instead of for the hot stove, that before he reaches that time, these two kings will have disappeared. Well, they disappeared 700 years before the time of Christ. It seems to be, it doesn't seem to have much relevance in that relation. And there have been commentators who said the statement, he will eat curds and honey, is a picture of the simple life of our Lord. But we have nothing in the New Testament to suggest that that is what it refers to. And when we look further on in the chapter, we find in verse 22, all who remain in the land will eat curds and honey. There'll be plenty of pastoral products, because the land will be open for the cows and for the bees to freely roam, and comparatively few people, not enough to do much cultivation, a condition of depopulation, a condition of devastation which came as a result of the Assyrian invasion. So that verses 15 and 16 come right back, it would seem, to the immediate situation. And here we have a problem, a very definite problem. Now, some try to get about it by what they call a double fulfillment. And I do not believe there is such a thing as double fulfillment. Now, if we are to say there will be great invasions, this is plural. There may be 2, 3, 6, we don't know how many. We are giving a plural prediction. But when we say that David became king, we are giving a specific event. There's no double fulfillment to it. When we say that God picked Saul to be king, or that Samuel told Saul he would become king, it refers to one specific event. And when we make a prediction which is not a general statement, but is a prediction of a specific event, it describes one thing. And if you're going to say, well, it has 2 or 3 different fulfillments, it leaves you without much solid ground on which to stand. And we have to make a sharp distinction. If we give a principle can be fulfilled in many situations. That is different. But a specific prediction such as the virgin birth has one fulfillment. Some have tried to say this is a prediction of the birth of Hezekiah. But the evidence is quite strong that Hezekiah was already at least 5 years old at this time when Isaiah spoke with his father Ahaz. It is definitely not a prediction of the birth of Hezekiah. We have no evidence of any virgin birth at that time. We have no evidence of anyone at that time to whom this could refer. Neither do we have any way in which verses 15 and 16 can refer to Christ. 14 refers to Christ, 15 and 16 refer to the immediate situation. Now, how do you make the transition? If you say a double fulfillment, this refers both to Christ and to that time. Well, verses 15 and 16 certainly don't refer to the time of Christ. But by the time he reaches the age of making simple choices, the land of the two kings you dread will be laid waste. There is a transition. Now, how is the transition to be understood? Personally, I feel, and a number of commentators feel, that what happens is that he speaks of the coming one whom God is going to send without giving any indication of when he is coming. We don't know when, we know he is going to come. And then we take his life as an imaginary measuring stick. In other words, we don't know when this virgin birth will occur, but if it were to occur during the present year, then before that time, these things would happen. It is using it simply as a measuring stick. I incline personally very strongly toward that interpretation of the relationship of these two verses with verse 14. Now, there's one other suggestion I've heard made that I would not say is wrong. It seems to me to be a possibility, though I like this one better. The other one is that when he says, he will eat curds and honey. Now, in English, that word he is a separate word. But in Hebrew, it is merely part of the verb. There's no emphasis on the he at all. And it could certainly be that we are told he's to take his son with him, whose name means a remnant will return, whose name suggests there's going to be devastation, so that there will be only a remnant, and that he points toward the boy beside him and says he will eat curds and honey when he reaches a certain age. that he says before the boy and points to the boy, his son who is with him. And that his son who is with him there is the measuring stick. That it changes from Christ to the son who is there. And you might say he points in that direction, perhaps. Now that is a possibility. I personally like the other better, that he thinks of Christ's age as if he were born now. It gives you a period of time. Yes? Chapter 8, verse 4 is referring to another boy, to Mahershal Hashbaz. And there we have a shorter period of time. No, this if this is a boy, at that time it'd be the older boy. That's the younger boy. Yes, what? Yes. It is not simple by any means. It is a difficult problem. I think we should recognize that it is a problem. But I do not see any escape as the Isaiah 7 stands from taking verse 14 as a prediction of the virgin birth of Christ. And I think the quotation by the angel in the book of Matthew, or even if it was simply Matthew's quotation, I think that makes it absolutely certain. Verse 14 refers to Christ. Now, if we take verses 15 and 16 in the light of the rest of the chapter, I don't see any way to escape from their referring not to Christ, but to the immediate situation. And so, my personal preference is to think that he means we don't know when Christ will come. We don't know when Emmanuel will come, but if he were to come now, before he would reach this age, these things will happen. That he takes imaginary life, the life because we don't know when it will be, uses it as a measuring stick to show what's going to happen in the very near future. That is the interpretation that I prefer, though the other is not impossible, I think, that he says before Sheher Jashub. After all, why did he bring Sheher Jashub along? Was it just for his name, or is there a little more purpose? I prefer the first, but I don't think the second's at all impossible. Mr. Miller?
Do you think Isaiah felt that he was very dear to him?
Well, I would think that as far as Isaiah was concerned, the Lord hadn't revealed it to him. He didn't know. And when he did, at this moment, now maybe as the Lord revealed other things to him later, he realized that it was quite a distance in the future. But at this point, he probably only knew what the Lord had revealed to him, which was what is stated here. Yes?
On the fourth interpretation, the son, was that Isaiah's son you said he was referring to? Yes.
That was Isaiah's son who's mentioned in verse 1, where the Lord told him to take Sheher Jashub, his son. And verse 3 is mentioned. He said, take your son, who has this name, a remnant will return.
Thank you.
Yes. Yes?
Is there a meaning in the Hebrew verb by having that description?
Yeah, Sheher
Jashub. No, I'm sorry. The whole idea of will know enough to refuse evil and so forth. Is there able to be a hypothetical sense in that Hebrew verb?
Yeah, it could just as well be. He will or he would before he would be. There's no distinction between will and would in the Hebrew like there is in English. There are comparatively few places where it is translated would, but there are places where all agree that that is the idea. Yes, you had?
Verses 14 and 15, a general statement that the depopulation will take place in a few years.
Yes, exactly, yes. Anything else on this? Yes?
So, if, according to you, verse 16 would be saying,
yes. Then it would give us a measuring stick that before he reaches a certain age, within a very few years, both these kings will be gone. Yes?
If this is the case, would this be a sign for Ahab?
No, it is a sign to God's people.
Okay.
It is a sign to God's people that they don't have to think that the house of David will have to put up with such as Ahaz forever, And it is a sign that Ahaz's clever scheme to deliver the land is actually going to bring you trouble rather than deliverance. Yes, Mr. Lycan?
In the first chapter of Matthew, the angel prophesies to the sons of David that this is a fulfillment of verse 14, but it doesn't say anything about verses 15 and 16.
That's right.
That would support that there is a separation here.
Yeah.
And happened a number of times in other places in the New Testament where the New Testament will pick and choose out of the whole passage.
Yes. Yes, the angel did not quote verses 15-16, just 14. Yeah, Mr. Bashir.
Jesus stopped in the middle of a passage, verse.
Yes, but... Yes. But we want to be very careful about arguments from silence. The fact that a verse is quoted and he stops there means that we do not have a New Testament guarantee that the next verse also applies to that time. But it doesn't prove that it doesn't either. In that case where Jesus stops in the quotation, some say that's the first coming up to there and the second coming from there on. But I think if you read it closely, that's quite questionable. But that's another area we better not get into. Now, the... I think then we have covered the main the principal matters in chapter 7, and these matters continue for a few verses into chapter 8. The Lord said to me, now I think I would guess that verse 1 of chapter 8 comes very, very soon after what preceded in chapter 7. That we're not told that it did, but it would seem to me from the situation that it did. Very soon after, that the Lord said to me, take, well, this word, which the NIV translates a large scroll, it is a word which occurs very seldom in the Hebrew, and we are not sure exactly what it means. Some people think of it as meaning like a tablet, like a stone monument, something like that. Just exactly what it was, we don't know, but somewhere where it could easily be seen, Isaiah was to write on it in plain letters the words Maher Shalal Hashbaz, which is the Hebrew for hasten the booty, hurry the spoil. And he puts this sign up. Ahaz is saying, he's telling his nobles secretly, the Assyrian will come soon. We'll be perfectly safe. We have nothing to worry about. But Isaiah asks Uriah the priest and Zechariah, the son of Zebrechiah, not the author of the biblical book Zechariah, but another Zechariah. He asks them to note the fact that at this time I have put up this sign. There is trouble ahead. There is difficulty. A remnant will return. But, in the meantime, hasten the booty, hurry the spoil. Then I went to the prophetess, and she conceived and gave birth to a son. And the Lord said to me, name him Maher Shalal Hashbaz. Before the boy knows how to say Avi and Imi, the two first sounds that the child is apt to learn to make, daddy and mommy. They come earlier. This is an earlier point than the other boys, you see. The other boy reaches the ability to make simple choices. Before that happens, there's going to be an end to the menace from Damascus and from Samaria. But before this boy is able just to make the simplest sounds that a baby first learns to make, before that time. But of course, this is a... By the time the boy's able to do that, it's a couple of years later than the previous situation. Before that, the wealth of Damascus and the plunder of Samaria will be carried off by the king of Assyria. And then we have a small break at the end of verse 4, of course. But here the Lord then speaks to him and... gives a rebuke for the people of the land, mingled with assurance of God's continued blessing. Rebuke for turning away from God, but assurance of continued blessing to God's people. Because this people has rejected the gently flowing waters of Shiloah. In the New Testament, there's no SH sound, so it makes it Siloam. It's the pool of Siloam. It has nothing to do with the Old Testament city of Shiloh, of course. It is the waters of Siloam. Because this people has rejected the gently flowing waters of Siloam, a figure for God's messages through his prophets and his people, and rejoices over Rezin and the son of Remaliah. Well, now, who are the people who are rejoicing over Rezin and the son of Remaliah? Most commentators think these are the people of the northern kingdom he's speaking of, and how God is punishing them. Some think that he refers to people in the southern kingdom who are turning against Ahaz and thinking they should support Rezin. I think the first is the more likely of the two, but probably he has the whole people of Israel to some extent in view. That the people of both northern and southern kingdom, instead of listening to the quiet voice of God and looking to him for their protection, that they, instead of that, are using these various human expedients to gain their protection. Therefore, the Lord is about to bring against them the mighty flood waters of the river. Now, this term, the river, is often used to mean the greatest river in that part of the world, the river Euphrates, which is used here as a figure of the great power of this rushing river, as a figure for the great force of the king of Assyria. The king of Assyria, with all his pomp, it will overflow all its channels, run over all its banks, and sweep on into Judah, swirling over it, passing through it, and reaching up to the neck. Its outspring spread wings will cover the breadth of, no, it doesn't say of the land, he says of your land. Of your land. And then the next word says, God with us. Immanuel. And most translators insert an O, because he says your land, and then he says God with us. And we've already been told about the birth of Emmanuel. So it is quite a reasonable conjecture that here Isaiah turns to Emmanuel and recognizes that though Ahaz is ruling over the land, he is a very degenerate representative of the house of David. It really is Emmanuel who is the true ruler. And this is Emmanuel's land. And even though God permits the Assyrian to overrun the land and brings this punishment for the sins of the people, yet it is Emmanuel's land. So you see another reason why this chapter is tightly bound with the previous one. We read there of the birth of Emmanuel, the coming birth, but here we see that Emmanuel is one who is already in existence. He is the true son of David. This is his land. And even though the Assyrian runs over it, there cannot be permanent, lasting destruction because it's Emmanuel's land. And then he turns and speaks ironically to the nations under the control of the Assyrians as they come and make their eventual attack in verse 30, chapters 36 to 37, which they think will result in the destruction of Jerusalem. He says, raise the war cry, you nations, and be shattered. Listen, all you distant lands, prepare for battle and be shattered. Prepare for battle and be shattered. Devise your strategy, but it will be thwarted. Propose your plan, but it will not stand, for Emmanuel. Now the NIV there translates Emmanuel, for God is with us. And of course, in both cases, you can translate it, God is with us, or you can transliterate Emmanuel. And both are true. God is with them. This is Emmanuel's land. And since it is Emmanuel's land, God is protecting it and watching over it. And even Sennacherib's mighty power will not be able to take Jerusalem, because God will miraculously intervene. Well then, as it continues there, he is still speaking to the people, so many of whom have turned away from God. And he says, do not call conspiracy everything these people call conspiracy. Do not fear what they fear. Do not dread it. The Lord Almighty is the one you are to regard as holy. He's the one you're to fear. He's the one you're to dread. And he will be a sanctuary. You don't need to try to get the Assyrian to come and protect you. You don't need to look to these human expedients. God has promised to protect you, and He will do it. If you don't trust in Him, you will not be established. But He will be a sanctuary that is understood to all those who put their trust in Him. But He goes on, but for both houses of Israel. Good reason to think above that He's referring to both the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom. But for both houses of Israel, He will be a stone that causes men to stumble and a rock that makes them fall. And for the people of Jerusalem, He will be a trap and a snare. Many of them will slumber, they will fall and be broken, they will be snared and captured. And at the end of verse 15, there is a minor break. There is a minor break, not a major one. Up to that point, He has been speaking about the way God is going to bring misery on those who are not following the Lord, on those who are not seeking to do His will, on those who are seeking these human expedients instead of trusting in the Lord. And as He sees the dark days coming under Ahaz, He says, bind up the testimony and seal up the law among my disciples. I will wait for the Lord who is hiding His face from the house of Jacob. I will put my trust in Him. Who speaks verses 16 and 17? Does Isaiah speak there or does Emmanuel speak there? Whom we have had referred to twice already in the chapter. Emmanuel is certainly already the Lord of the land. Emmanuel is God's own king. This is Emmanuel's land. That's why the Assyrian cannot completely destroy it. This is Emmanuel's land, and Emmanuel may be speaking, or Isaiah is Emmanuel's representative. He is speaking on Emmanuel's behalf. And so he says in verse 18, here am I, and the children the Lord has given me. We are signs and symbols in Israel from the Lord Almighty who dwells on Mount Zion. And so here Emmanuel is speaking through Isaiah. He is giving a principle which was true there, that Isaiah and his followers, they were keeping alive the true message of God, even though so much of the land was turning away from God. They are God's representatives, He and the followers that God has given Him. But it is Emmanuel working through Isaiah. And so we find in the book of Hebrews, in the second chapter and the 13th verse, that these words of Emmanuel are quoted. And it says there, so Jesus is not ashamed to call them brothers. That's the end of verse 11. He says, I will declare your name to my brothers. In the presence of the congregation, I will sing your praise. And that is quoted from the 22nd Psalm, that marvelous prediction of Jesus' crucifixion and of the glory that should follow. And then he says, and again, I will put my trust in him, which is exactly the last part of verse 17. I will put my trust in him. And again he says, here am I and the children God has given me. So the author of the book of Hebrews is justified in quoting these statements as statements by Christ, by Emmanuel, the pre-existent Christ, who was working through Isaiah and was in them expressing a principle which was exemplified as Isaiah and his little band of followers kept alive the knowledge of God in a nation that was turning away from him to so great an extent, and that was exemplified as the followers of Christ went out into all the world to carry the message of salvation in the midst of a wicked world. God has never promised that by the gospel we are going to conquer the whole world. But he has promised that through the gospel we can bring a message of salvation that will reach many, and that he will be with us to save many out of this wicked world. And so Emmanuel can say it through each one of us, as he said through Isaiah. If we can put our trust in the Lord, and we can look to God to give us followers. who will join with us in standing for God. Well, now at the end of verse 18 there, I feel that there is a rather important break, because in what follows, we do not have direct reference to these previous situations, but we have a warning first against spiritism, a warning against the practice, doubtless widespread then and certainly very widespread in our day, of consulting mediums and spirits in order to try to find what is going to happen in the future. Should not a people inquire of their God, he says. Why consult the dead on behalf of the living? To the law and to the testimony. If they do not speak according to this word, they have no light of dawn. And then from there, the next few verses show a condition of distress, a condition of misery, a condition of suffering, distressed and hungry. They roam through the land. They become, when they're famished, they become enraged. And looking upward, they curse their king and their God. Now, some take that look upward as meaning that they cease what is wrong and look upward. Others take it, no matter what direction you look, you see nothing but misery. And when you get to chapter 9, verse 1, you find that there's a difference of translation as to whether he will glorify Galilee of the Gentiles or he will more greatly distress Galilee of the Gentiles. And of course, both of them are true. Because he describes here the area in the land of Zebulun, the land of Naphtali, Galilee of the Gentiles, the area in the northern kingdom into which the Assyrian armies first came. That area in which the darkness first came of the Assyrian attack and conquest. In that very area, he says, the people walking in darkness are going to see a great light. And the New Testament says that great light, it was what came first in that area, because that's where Jesus began his preaching. And Matthew quotes this passage as fulfilled in Christ, as in the very area where the darkness from the Assyrian attack first entered the land, in that very area, Jesus begins his preaching and his bringing the wonderful message of light. Well, I think I will stop for today. And if you will please review everything up to this point and try to be here on time for sure next time, because I'd like to not take any more time than we have to for this short test, about 20 minutes at the beginning of the next hour.